Well, good morning. This is the Lou Rockwell Show, and how great to have as our guest this morning, Professor Peter Dale Scott. Professor Scott is a former Canadian diplomat, professor of English at the University of California at Berkeley. He's a poet, a researcher, and it's especially in his role as a researcher that we're talking to him today. He's the author of four very important books, one of which is coming out in November, in fact, can be pre-ordered now, and that's what I want to talk to him about today, The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. Again, it's going to be published in November, but you can pre-order it on Amazon right now. Professor Scott, once in a while you hear that maybe Turkey has a deep state, or maybe some other foreign country has a deep state, but surely in the indispensable nation, we wouldn't have such a thing. But tell us, what it is, why it's important, and why really every American who cares about liberty and civil liberties, economic liberties, privacy, peace, any of the important issues of our time, should be reading your book and care about these issues very, very much.
I do think that the issue of the deep state is as important as you just suggested, and that understanding it is better is a first step in order to deal with all of our problems. But since you brought up Turkey, it's very relevant. The term deep state did actually originate there, where they had, a better defined problem, a very severe one, which was that the government from time to time, which was ostensibly civilian and had elections, the government would be overthrown by a coup or by selective assassinations. And there was a structure in the country that was, and by the way, a structure which some people say was set up with CIA assistance, a kind of Turkish equivalent of Gladio, as we had in Italy and Belgium and other countries, that was directing the political system and intervening whenever necessary in a very violent way. Another situation like that would be Colombia, where you had these parapolitical death squads, the Guerrillas Secuestradores. What we have in America is not as extreme and as structured as that. I make a point of saying in my book that it's not an alternative structure to the state. It is more like a system that really from the beginning of American politics has been present and to a greater or less degree has also been interfering and getting its way. I decided to call the book The American Deep State after another researcher, Mike Lofgren, did a very good article and shared it on radio, Bill Moyers' show, back in January. And I had originally thought of focusing my book on something else, but I think it is time to recognize that whereas most of our state, the public state, is subject to checks and balances, is governed by the Constitution, we have set up agencies which are not subject to the same kind of control. And the two most obvious are the NSA and the CIA, which are major parts of the deep state I'm talking about, but by no means all of it, because I'm thinking of these unchecked agencies, but also of powerful elements in the country that have special access to particularly the CIA. And that's why I made a point of mentioning Wall Street and Big Oil in the subtitle of the book, because they are very well represented in the CIA. You could really say, I give a very brief historical account of the setting up of the CIA, which I did in more detail in two earlier books, The Road to 9/11 and American War Machine, that it was essentially an idea that came out of Wall Street. Truman was very reluctant to have a big spy agency like this. He had closed down OSS, and it was pressure from Wall Street that persuaded him to do it, and he accepted a blueprint for the CIA, which had essentially been drawn up by Alan Dulles and a few other Wall Street bankers and lawyers in New York rather than in Washington. So that's why it's a central part of the deep state. But as I say, the deep state is a system and not a structure. And then we come, Mike Lofgren compared the deep state to an iceberg. And he said, we see the visible 10%, and down below it is the really important 90%. That's a good metaphor in a way, but what's bad about it is it suggests that the 90% is as structured as the 10%, and it really isn't. It's more informal. People know each other. There's a milieu, but they have access to power through the CIA and through other means. Recently, we have a problem with the outsourcing of intelligence because something like 70% of the intelligence budget now, which has been huge since 9/11, is outsourced and goes to private corporations like Booz Allen Hamilton and SAIC. And these are run by in and outers, people who will do a stint at the, as head of the CIA. And then they sometimes come from Booz Allen Hamilton. They go back to Booz Allen Hamilton. The result is that the intelligence budget is not something that Congress really has control of. And that's been true since the beginning of the CIA. They've always had access to funds that were not voted by Congress. And that's why they've always had powers that are not part of the constitutional structure of this country.
Professor, is that why we see so much evidence of the CIA's involvement in the international drug trade as a way to make money?
Yes. I talk more about that in American War Machine. Yes, it's very relevant. It's also relevant, I think, that the money doesn't go into the CIA bank accounts, as far as I can see. It just means that the CIA will hook up with powerful elements in other countries that become essentially like local armies for the CIA, but the CIA doesn't have to pay for them because they are funded by drugs. And that was certainly true of the Contras in the early stages of the Contra operations down in Nicaragua. But it isn't just the CIA that has an interest then in the drug traffic. Wall Street, too. They're beginning to crack down on this now, but for a long time, the big Wall Street banks had special private banks that dealt in the laundering of drug profits. And this drug money was a major factor for Wall Street. It enabled, for example, Wall Street to make loans to countries on the assumption that countries would be able to pay them back because of the amount of money being made from drugs in those countries. It's a very complicated story, and I could go on and on about it because it's an interest of mine, but that is not very much talked about in this particular book. It's mentioned, but not very much.
I was interested when you said that this goes back to the, you know, to the beginning of the American government, but really metastasized after World War II, as you say, with the founding of the CIA. And have there been any opponents whose names you might have heard of anyway, of this process? You're an opponent, obviously. There are other important intellectual opponents. Anybody in politics who's opposed this?
I think every country or every major country has a deep state. And it's not so much I'm an opponent of it, but I'm an opponent of its being so secret that nobody is checking it. I just want us to understand what's going on in this country better. You know, as a former diplomat, I understand that there has to be secrecy in certain matters, but secrecy that is totally unchecked sort of takes over. And where you have complete secrecy, you don't have democracy. You can't have both. So have there been any political opponents? I think it was a very important moment back in the Iran-Contra hearings, and some people may remember this. Oliver North was being quizzed by this special committee, and Congressman Brooks, Jack Brooks from Texas, said he had just read an article by Alfonso Chardy in the Miami Herald that said that there was a parallel government that was planning for suspension of the Constitution. And quite, I think the whole of Congress should have been in an uproar about that. But in fact, it was just one man. And in this committee, Colonel North, I understand that you've been part of a committee that is planning for the suspension of the American Constitution. Could you tell us something about that? And there was a brief discussion between the North's lawyer and the chairman of the committee, who who, by the way, was a Democrat, a decent Democrat, Senator Inouye. And Senator Inouye said, with all due respect, I think we should go into that in executive session, meaning that it did, it was happening, and it was, that Chardy was right. And now we know a lot more about this, what we call continuity of government planning. Now, this is something that is absolutely central to my book. And for a while, I was thinking of putting COG, continuity of government planning, which is exactly that, planning for suspension of the Constitution if there's an atomic attack, say, or something like that. I thought that should really be the heart of the book. But there was always a problem because my editors said, nobody knows what COG is, so you can't put it in the title. But it is a very important fact that since the Eisenhower days, there have been people planning for just that. And because they are a secret committee, they have to have a certain amount of continuity. And Eisenhower arranged from the very beginning that there would be people on that committee who were not in the government. Two people who've been on that committee since Reagan reauthorized it in 1982 by a national security decision, number 55, the two of the people who've been on that committee from 1982 up to the year 2000 were Donald Rumsfeld and, of course, Dick Cheney. Even though Rumsfeld at no point was in the government, he was a CEO of a private corporation, a pharmaceutical company. And at the end of that period, Cheney, for a while, he was Secretary of Defense under the first Bush. But at the end, he was also a CEO of the corporation, Halliburton, very big, by the way, in the oil development industry. And here were these two people not in the government planning for the suspension of the Constitution. And even more remarkably, in 2001, now they are in the government. And on a day when President Bush is not in town, the two of them implement the plans that they've been working on for more than 20 years. This is, I think, a very central fact about our recent politics. And everything about 9/11, I think, has to be looked at in the light of the very major changes that were brought in at that time, some of them later given a legal cover in the Patriot Act and things like that. These were plans for detention, warrantless surveillance, which we all know about now from Ed Snowden. That was planned for 20 years before it was implemented September the 11th, 2001.
And it hasn't been unimplemented.
No, and you know what? It's given a measure of authority by a proclamation that Bush made on September 14th of 2001, which was a state of emergency. Everyone should know that we are living in a state of emergency, and that allows the government to do all kinds of things it wouldn't normally do. But what is very interesting about this is that this was a power, again, these states of emergency go way back. And in the wake of Watergate, when Congress started looking into secret government at that time, they found that America had been in a state of emergency since the Korean War. And even the Attorney General wasn't aware of it. And so they said, this is not good. They terminated the state of emergency. And one of the post-Watergate reforms was the National Emergencies Act, which set up conditions for states of emergency. And one of the conditions is that if a president declares a state of emergency, then Congress shall, within 6 months, review it and either affirm it or terminate it. And that's a requirement in the law for what Congress must do. And how often has Congress done it since 2001? Not once. And a former congressman and I, back in 2008, just before Obama was elected, we said that, you know, Congress should do this and the new president should not renew. By the way, each state of emergency now has to be renewed every year. Bush, George W. renewed it for all these years. And we said Obama should not renew it and Congress should review it and terminate it. And neither of those things have happened. That is to say, Obama has continued to renew it every year, and Congress has continued not to do anything about it. And we tried to mount a national campaign, and one congressman said to his constituent, I understand the rules of the National Emergencies Act have been overridden by the new continuity of government procedures. Well, if that's true, then in at least one respect, in a century, the Constitution has already been overridden because a statute has been overridden by a private, I shouldn't say private here, but by a secret power, and this is a matter of very great concern to me. And of course, the warrantless surveillance, and I'd like to really emphasize the warrantless detention is an extremely important consequence of what's happened. The surveillance has affected everybody, and now everybody's talking about it, but detention only affected Muslims, really. But right after 9/11, something 1,000 or more Muslims were detained. Some of them were tortured. I talked to somebody, an academic, who was rounded up and beaten so badly that he had blood in his urine. And this man wasn't even an Arab. He was an Iranian Shiite professor. Absolutely had nothing to do with 9/11, no reason to suspect that he did, but he was detained for months and, as I say, tortured. And, you know, there's no fuss about that in the press at all, which really upsets me.
I wonder how much the fact that there is no fuss in the press whatsoever about any of these things, or for that matter in the Congress, has to do with the fact that the NSA has got blackmailable information on all these people.
Oh, well, they do. I have a chapter, by the way, tracing these powers back to J. Edgar Hoover. And there's no doubt that Hoover, who's here in this business without any authorization, in fact, he had more than one attorney general tell him to stop collecting intelligence on people and to get rid. He had a list of people who might be rounded up in the case of an emergency. And he was told flatly in 1943 by Attorney General Biddle to get rid of the list. And what Hoover did was change the name of the list. He canceled the list he had and put all the names into a new list with a slightly more innocuous name. And the same thing happened in 1975. Then they found that the Congress found that he had this list. They said, stop it. So this was post-Hoover, by the way. So the FBI stopped it, put the names in a different list. And that's the list that Oliver North was working with when he had very serious plans to detain hundreds of thousands of people. And I think that I'm not sure of this, but I think that those plans and those lists are the basis of the detention that took place after 2001, and which is now used mostly, of course, for it's been deflected into detaining and then returning non-documented immigrants. But it goes back to Hoover. Hoover did that. I don't think that is the source of the silence in the media and everywhere. I think that that's my idea of the deep state. I haven't mentioned the media, but they are part of it too. And in fact, when Eisenhower first set up this COG planning procedure, he put Frank Stanton of CBS on the committee. So the media have been part of this planning structure. And I think there is a consensus that the media should not touch this material at all. Let's go back to, I would have thought it was pretty newsworthy that Congressman Brooks asks Oliver North, are you planning for the suspension of the Constitution? And Senator Inouye says, we can't go into that in a public session. You would think that would merit a news story. There wasn't one news story. The New York Times was printing verbatim all of the hearings, and so those words were in a back page of the New York Times. There was no story about it because it's part of the deep political system.
The only person I can remember talking about it then and subsequently is Ron Paul, who's very much an opponent of continuity of government and all this sort of stuff. But it's true that you certainly don't read it in any of the media. And isn't academia as well part of the deep state?
Yes, I totally agree with you. But I'm talking to Lou Rockwell, aren't I?
Yes, sir.
Well, you've talked about it, I believe, and I
yes,
put you in my
sure.
book as one of the few good people that we should deal with. I don't, you probably didn't know that, but yes, I single you out as one of the rare people who's done this. And I'm aware, yes, Ron Paul, I'm not so sure about his son, but yes, Ron Paul has been a good person on this. I find that very hopeful because I would consider myself in many matters more on the left, and Ron Paul is often identified as being more on the right. But I think that what this country needs and potentially could and should have is a coalition of people who, from whether from the left or the right, have become upset at the amount of power that is accrued to the center. So that I would say a terrorist center, because the American government is doing overseas amounts to terror. I mean, if you're dropping drones on villages, that's terrorizing people, and it is a source of a great deal of the problems that we now face in the Middle East. So yes, there are some people, not very many yet, and now when you're talking about individual members of Congress, it may be there that people are frightened to confront the deep political system. I would point out that going back at least to the Vietnam War, anybody who's tried to do something about these powers, take the two people who voted against the Tonkin Gulf resolution, for example, Senator Morris and Senator Gruening, both defeated in the next election. Senator Church was a mammoth hero, really.
I yes, think, yes, its great hero.
And defeated in the next election. The congressman who really did most to alert Congress to Iran-Contra, defeated. And in fact, the Reagan administration had steered money into a special State Department committee that it was called Public Information, but what they were actually doing was targeting the people in Congress who had opposed the Contras and using public money to get their constituents to defeat them. So it is dangerous for individual congressmen to do this, and they know it. And it is possible that President Obama knows it too and is constrained in what he does, because certainly the rhetoric when he came in and the speech that he made about the Middle East in Cairo, I believe, back in 2009, it was a completely different approach to the Middle East from what we're seeing now with the drones and the aerial bombings. And there, I think my analysis is that there are the interests in, you know, we have a very strange economy now. We're not really competitive as a civilian economy. We have a very militarized economy, and every now and then a militarized economy has to have a war. And back in Vietnam, they said, you know, it's not a good war, but it's the only war we've got. And this ISIS war, I think, is a terrible war, but for some people, I'm sure they're saying it's the only war we've got.
Well, no question that the whole military-industrial complex, all the merchants of death, as they were called in the 1920s, are constantly agitating for war and obviously for spending, for selling weapons overseas.
Right.
This is all obviously a key part of the deep state as well.
I do, by the way, talk quite a lot about arms sales overseas, and particularly arms sales. They used to be to Iran and Saudi Arabia, and now Iran, of course, is had a change of government with the fall of the Shah, but the Emirates, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia. And it's not just that we strengthen the dollar by selling arms to those countries. This is where big oil comes into the picture, because the only stability really that we offset the costs of importing oil from abroad by arms sales to the countries we sell to. And well, it's quite complicated, and I go into it. But what I want to stress here is that since the sale of the AWACS back in the early 80s to Saudi Arabia, a percentage of those arms sales has been kicked back into secret bank accounts that used to be handled by Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia in the Riggs National Bank in Washington, which essentially was a slush fund to fund covert operations. So that's another way that the CIA is able to escape direction from Washington and the administration, because they had access to these funds of Prince Bandar, and that paid for, well, it paid for the Contras, it paid for operations in South Africa, Angola, and it's a whole kind of second budget just going along with the deep state being a kind of parallel state.
Professor, are you concerned about a roundup? Are you concerned about if there's something that happens, either contrived by the bad guys or something that's a surprise to them, that they're going to round up Americans and put them in internment camps, and Muslims too, of course?
No, well, Muslims is something else, but no, for the rest of us, I think that would be, if that happened, it's not inconceivable, but I think it would be, in a sense, a great setback for this system. The system wants what we have now. So if that were to happen, then you would have people going underground, and we would have a situation comparable to, say, the 1960s, when there was fear of a roundup then, so a lot of the left went underground and started blowing up buildings. So I don't think they want that. And so I think it's unlikely. I think that they are, I suspect, you know, well, I mean, actually, I don't suspect, I know that at present, Muslims in this country are being subjected to a special kind of surveillance, that they have informants in every mosque, and they coerce the FBI. The FBI has excellent guidelines on how to recruit informants. Unfortunately, they don't stick to those guidelines, and people get hauled in on very minor offenses, misdemeanors, and they're told that the book will be thrown at them unless they become informants. And this is terribly demoralizing, as you can imagine, for these various mosques. I don't want to suggest that there is no problem for them to be worrying about, because part of the problem is that Saudi Arabia, for decades, since around 1979, I would say, when they had a huge crisis inside Saudi Arabia, they have also been playing politics with mosques and offering large sums of money to mosques if they would hire Wahhabi preachers. And so there is a problem. But the way that the FBI has been dealing with it, I think, is I wish they would keep to their own rules, which they don't. There have been whole books written about this.
Not the first time that's happened, but
I see signs that people are becoming concerned about this and more aware of it. And we owe some of our awareness to whistleblowers like Edward Snowden, who at least briefly created quite a wave of concern, even in Congress. And the important thing is to be able to build from that concern and do something. You know, I say in my book that the government right now is seized with a kind of mania, madness, and it's not the first time. The Palmer raids was a period of madness. The McCarthyism was a period of madness. They terminated, and one might hope that this would also terminate. The risk is that one of the byproducts of this is the huge amount of wealth that is being accrued, not just by the top 1%, but the top 0.01% of this country. And that is a factor both as a result of what I'm talking about and also as a cause of it. And it may have tipped us so much in the direction of secret power in the hands of Wall Street and other people. Look at the bailout of Wall Street. They it didn't matter whether it was Bush or it was Obama. The Wall Street appointees just took a lot of federal our money and gave it to these big banks, because that's part of the system. We have to fight that, and the first step in fighting it is being conscious of it.
Well, I think you're right that there is a reason for optimism. I see it especially among young people. Even when you see Apple and Google saying they're going to encrypt their new operating systems in a way that nobody can read them, including themselves, and certainly not the CIA or the NSA or
Right.
Much of the outrage of the FBI, I noticed, talking about how terrible this is, and they can't spy on every single message.
I know, it's so weird. Here they are reinforcing the Fourth Amendment, and the government's talking about this as a threat to democracy. It is very, very ironic.
Well, it's a battle, but it's always been a battle, and thanks to people like you, Snowden, and others, people are being alerted. So I'm very excited about your new book. We're going to do everything we can here to promote it. And the deep state, it's the reality of American politics and American governance and of the American corporate state. And it's so important that people know about it. So thank you for all the work that you've done and continue to do. And thanks for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you. And I thank you for all the work that you do.
Thank you, Professor. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, thanks so much for listening to the Lou Rockwell Show today. Take a look at all the podcasts. There have been hundreds of them. There's a link on the LRC front page. Thank you.